Welcome back. That's James Brown. And there's a book called Kill 'Em and Leave, Searching for James Brown and the American Soul by the National Book Award-winning author James McBride. The last time I was on here was talking about The Good Lord Bird. It was by phone. And James McBride, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Nice to be here. Thank you very much. You guys had really had it really going on here.
We did.
Yes, indeed.
This is, as I told you, I read this book yesterday. I was just flying through. My wife went to bed and said, okay. That's right. I got to get this done. I got to finish this book. But it's an amazing piece of work, I think. And each one of your works, to me, is very different. They're all like journeys through our world and explaining race in America and more in your way of doing it, both in fiction and memoir. But this one was also a personal journey, it seemed.
Well, it had to be that way because I couldn't figure out a way to write about James Brown that was different than what everyone else said. And also, you know, I wanted to write a book that I would read, you know.
Right.
I read these history books, and I like the first part where they say, you know, I could have never done this without my friend Joe and my wife Amy. And then I start reading the history part, and I go, well, you know. And then I just go to the back and see how the guy died, and that's the end of it. So I didn't want to write one of those kinds of books, you know. I wanted to write a book that, like, that I would read, you know.
Well, so, and you did it. I think that there's a page. Let me just start this way. On page 8, there's a piece where you write. Let me see if I have this here right. That's not the part I wanted to get to. See, that's what happens when you read a book the day before. But here we go. You write about the South very deeply in this book, and you write about James Brown. And you write, said, yeah, James Brown never once made the cover of Rolling Stone talking about the Rolling Stones and how they took his music and they closed for him and came much after him. Never made the Rolling Stone magazine during his life. To the music world, he was an odd appendage, a kind of freak, a large rock in the road that you couldn't get around, a clown, a black category. He was a super talent, a great dancer, a real show, a laugher. A drug addict, a troublemaker, all hair and teeth, a guy who couldn't stay out of trouble. The man simply defied description. The reason? Brown was a child of a country in hiding, America's South. That was a profound little statement, I thought.
Well, you know, it took me a while to come up with it, I guess. he was more really a Southerner than a black man, I think, in some ways. Because, you know, he had that down South thing where he lived in the South. I mean, he lived in the North for a while, you know, for 10 years, but he lived in the South, and he had all the Southern things that those of us who have relatives or who grew up in the South understand. You know, he's very religious. His whole mentality about America was steeped in the whole business of how black Southerners live, which is that, you know, they know that, well, you know, the South is kind of so you kind of like know your place, but, you know, for blacks, it's sort of the kind of place where you kind of just know you can't. The white man's evil is going to drop on you like raindrops at some point. So you're just waiting. You're always fearful, and waiting for it to happen. You know it's coming. You don't know when, and you don't know what form, but you know it's coming. So that fear dominated his life, and in some ways, in some respect, I think it killed his reputation as well, because you can't really understand James Brown without understanding that his life is really a metaphor for racism in America and how America deals with race. It was interesting to hear some of the talk earlier. People are talking, you know. We have these same conversations in New York, you know. I mean, it's just the same old story, but it's a story with a different dynamic when you start looking at how it affects someone as powerful and as rich and as successful as James Brown was. Because ultimately, he too was a victim of the kind of racism that is just eating away at all of us. At the end of his life, his management team were two white Southerners, two good old boys, and a black judge, black magistrate. And of course, at the end of his life, they suffered too as well, because he left all of his money, about $100 million, to set up a charitable foundation to educate poor children, black and white, in South Carolina and Georgia. That was 10 years ago. And in 10 years, not a single kid has received a penny of that money.
You focus on that a bunch in this book.
Well, I didn't mean to. I don't like to write about politics and lawyers and stuff because I think a lot of them are just crooks, and I don't have any interest in that. I mean, I'm a creative writer. I'm not
right.
Mike Wallace from 60 Minutes. but part of the, you know, part of that story is the lawsuit And so the book is not about that. I spent a couple chapters talking about it. But you have to mention it. You have to explain it to people in a way they understand, in real simple layman's terms. But that's only part of his life. I mean, that's part of his life. I mean, first of all, that would never happen with John Lennon or Elvis Presley. It just wouldn't happen. But secondly, that's part of the reason why James Brown has been so misrepresented by history, despite the many books that have been written about him.
And what you just said there, and it made me think about this as I was reading the book, but what you just said also just brought it to the fore for me, when you just said that wouldn't happen to John Lennon or Elvis Presley, right? And I was thinking about this piece I saw, this white guy who bought this plantation in Louisiana, and then it turned his life around, and he created this museum of slavery. And when he was interviewed, he said, you know, when white people come here, the first thing they say is, why can't they just get over it? And he said, it's because white folks don't understand the it. And even what you just said then in describing James Brown and John Lennon, that's part of the it that people have a hard time getting over.
Well, I mean, look, I have a friend, one of my best friends. He's a Jewish guy from Philly. And his parents were both Holocaust survivors. His mother lived in a sewer for 14 months. And he had a friend from Israel that came here one time. And she needed a ride to the airport. She was in New York, and he lives in Philly. So I gave her a ride to the airport. And we were sitting in the car driving to the airport. And we were crossing 125th Street going to the Triborough Bridge. And I said to her those words. I said, well, you know, why can't you? Because she was the daughter of Holocaust survivors. And I said to her, why don't you, can't you just get over it? I mean, you know, live your life in Israel. And she pointed out the windshield of the car to Harlem, and she asked me, she said, when did slavery end? And that ended the conversation right there. So, listen, Paul, you know, what's his name? John Lennon, Paul McCartney. Mm-hmm. They don't walk through supermarkets and hear ninth chords borrowed from their history. There are musicians in this town that people don't even know, who are living, that people don't know. I mean, Gary Thomas, for example, is one of the baddest tenor saxophone players in the world, lives here. Dennis Chambers, there's so many.
Mm-hmm.
People don't even know who they are. Black people don't know who they are. You know, I go see Dave Koz and Kenny G. And I see places loaded with. I go to blues festivals and see just white folks out there. So some of this is about history and understanding who your own history is, but some of understanding what your own history is. So the thing about James Brown was that, in addition to being a great musical innovator, and he put together a band which is probably the greatest rhythm and blues band ever, was that when he. As he tried to conduct his life, and he was much beloved all throughout Black America, people really misunderstood what he was trying to do. And so the focus, especially at the end of his life, was on the drugs and the imprisonment and so forth. But the only reason why he fell into those things was because he was so deeply hurt and disappointed in large part with how his life had been conducted and the life of the community that he loved so much had been conducted. And some of that, he felt, was self-induced, and some of that was, you know, I heard the caller earlier saying, you know, we're coming to the community to help you, how dare you? You know, look, when you take away the tax base and you take away the stores and you take away, you know, the schools and you mess things up, middle-class people are going to just move out. They're just going to go away. And then you're left with the poor who are going to suffer. If you're not smart enough to figure that out, then you probably shouldn't be a developer. You should probably just work on Wall Street somewhere and just make your money. I'm at the age where, you know, and one of the things this book about James Brown taught me was that when you're successful, no matter what your color, but particularly if you're African-American, you're successful, there's a lonely place that you live in, and nobody really understands your pain. The man lived in an enormous amount of pain, and he made some people around him suffer as well. But at the end of his life, he gave everything that he earned in his life back to the community. Not one book that's been written about James Brown has ever talked about, number one, the will that he left behind. Never talked about the fact that when he was a boy, his family was displaced by the country's biggest nuclear bomb-making facility. I mean, he lived in a small town called Ellenton, South Carolina, where in 1951, the government just came, took 361 square miles of land, made everybody move churches, stores, house. They just moved them all and built the biggest nuclear bomb-making uranium plant that still exists now. And James Brown was a victim of that. His whole family was scattered. We talked about displacement here in Baltimore. Well, that kind of displacement has been going on for, you know, hundreds of years, a couple hundred years at least. So many aspects of his life are discussed in this book because because that's what made the man. It wasn't just the music. It was the world. It was the world that created him. And so he's a metaphor for not just African-American life, but for American life, you know.
And you the one line you have, I think, early in the book about this, where you say the title of the book itself, Kill Him and Leave, but his past he could not kill and leave. And you have this incredible chapter in here about the Gaines family and how and his first wife Velma's family, who they were, how they grew up, what they experienced as sharecroppers, what they experienced his grandfather in the chain gang and fleeing, or his uncle, right. I guess, and chain gang and fleeing, right. And ending up in this town. And so, I mean, that he couldn't flee there. That was sort of deep in his soul about who he was and where he came from.
Absolutely. Look, the older you get, the more you become who you really are anyway. I mean, at the end of his life, James Brown lived just a few miles from where he was, from the Ellington town where he was, and Barnwell, where he was born. In fact, there were these two giant towers, radio towers, above this bomb-making facility that you could see for miles, and he could see them from the front porch of his house. And he used to tell Charles Bobbitt, who was his manager, he said, "You see that, Mr. Bobbitt? That's the government. The government, they're listening. They can hear everything I say. They're listening through my teeth." You know, he was paranoid at the end of his life because he'd been cleaned to the walls by the IRS twice. As a boy, he learned that the government, if they wanted something, they could just come into your house and hang their hat on the rack and tell you to leave. He didn't know who to trust. His great band had vacated him. He was hard to deal with. You know, all the great musicians, Pee Wee Ellis and Fred Wesley,
Maceo,
they'd all gone. So, and his first wife was his, well, his first wife loved him dearly. And she's never been interviewed before. And she talks in the book about
But James she talked Brown. To you.
Yeah, she did. She did. And I was very honored to meet her and to talk to her. She worked. This is a woman who raised his two sons, his two eldest sons, one of whom, Teddy, died.
Right.
But the other thing is that when she says that when they broke up after about 10. First of all, the fiction that James Brown lived in the basement of Bobby Bird's house when he was with the Famous Flames is just, it's just not true. I mean, that's, you know, his first wife said, you know, from 1951 to 1955, he wasn't living in nobody's basements because we had a house. And we had, you know, and I ironed his shirts, and nobody was going to have my husband living in their basement. I mean, Miss Velma was just, you know, she's just, and she worked in a factory after they divorced for 30 years. And, you know, a couple times during the course of her life, people came to the house and knocked on the door. Lawyers said, you know, I can get you millions of dollars. And she said, no.
Yep.
She said to Mr. Brown, I need a house to raise our boys in. He bought some land. He built her a house. And they were friends until he died. He called her from the hospital. And she was very hurt that he never told her he was in the hospital dying. So she was a friend to him all his life. His first wife and he were very good friends throughout his life. Anytime someone died in her family, he would come off the road and go to the funeral. There was a different James Brown with her that I saw and experienced in the course of learning about him in this book. Very kind, sensitive, and troubled man.
And you were talking about Velma, and I was thinking about the depth of the friendships that he kept for so much of his life that you write about in this book a lot. And the two people where are my notes? Why am I blind? Leon Austin and Emma McBauman. Leon and Emma.
Yeah.
I mean, see, this says, to me, it's a mark. All the other stuff you can say about James Brown, part of what we got from this book, for me, just as he is the man, is the depth of the friendships he had that were old and what they meant, like with these folks here.
Yeah, well, he met Leon Austin when he moved to Augusta as a boy, and Leon was his friend in elementary school. And when Brown was in elementary school, you know, he was a ragged, you know, dark-skinned kid from the bad side of town, didn't have the right kind of clothes and so forth. And when Leon brought him home to his house, Leon's mother made both of them undress, put them in the tin tub and scrubbed them both down. And said, now I can stand y'all because I couldn't stand you before. And so he became, and Leon Austin took him to the United House of Prayer where James Brown heard for the first time the kind of Pentecostal or apolistic music from Apolistic Church, I think they call it. And that affected him deeply. And Leon also taught him his first piano lessons. And they were friends for all the way. Leon and his wife, Miss Emma, were James Brown's friends until Leon died. And then Miss Emma was James Brown's friend until he died.
You talk right in the book how he would just call.
He'd call out the blue. You know, he'd say, you know, what you doing? What you reading? I want to bring it over here. Tell me
where's the vegetable soup?
Yeah, bring me some soup, you know. But he didn't ask for things like that. That's the thing. He was so proud. He would just say, did you make any of that vegetable? Are you still making that vegetable soup? In other words, can I have some, you know? And she worked at his radio station, and he would often fire people, and, you know, and she'd say, she'd do something, and he'd fire her, and she would just stay right on the job because she knew that in a couple hours he'd come back, and he said, didn't you call that promoter? And, you know, who's the name of that promoter again? Or did you get the rice and beans that we were supposed to eat? You know, he didn't have the ability to say, I'm sorry. But he had the ability to let people know that he really did care about them and love them. And he was very generous. He was very generous in his own community, and he was very generous to his friends as well.
So, and I don't want to give people the impression that the entire book's about how great he was. I mean, you talk about everything in this book in terms of his struggles, but you look at his struggles through a different lens.
I don't sugarcoat his life. I mean, I don't spend a whole lot of time talking about his illegitimate children and the affairs he had, because that's just not interesting to me. Everybody has that. Not everyone, but it's just not, it doesn't tell me, that's one aspect of the man. But he had other elements that are not really talked about that I found interesting as a musician, for example. You know, he had this reputation as being a tyrant band leader. Now, I played in many bands, and some of the people who are really, you know, really famous and known as really beautiful people are horrible people to work for. Just horrible, man. You know, they sleep with your girlfriend and fire you and hire you back because they know you need the money. I mean, you know, he wasn't the only one that was a difficult person to work for. But then the knife cuts the other way, too. You know, when you're running a band, which I've done, it's not easy. You know, you got one guy who's a great musician, but he never shows up on time. You got a guy who's a really nice guy, but he can't cut the part. This one drinks. That one smokes weed. This one has a drug problem. This one needs an advance because he can't pay his rent. And they don't deal with the promoters, the DJs, the record company. You know, the fans, all the publicity, the media, they don't have to do that. They just come and they hit and they leave. And so it's your job to. So he had a very tenuous relationship with his musicians. And some of these guys were extraordinarily gifted artists. But just because someone's an extraordinarily gifted artist doesn't mean that they're a great person to have as a sideman. You have to run a band. And he was running a band 320 nights a year. So it wasn't that easy. And he was doing it at a time, especially in the late 50s and into the 60s, where travel was issue, you know, and they were competing with Motown, which had some heavy hitters, and then later competing with, you know, Philadelphia Sound, Sound of Philly, and Isaac Hayes, and Sly and the Family Stone, Earth, Wind, and Fire. And James Brown saw all of them as his competitors. And he saw, once when Isaac Hayes was broke, someone knocked on his door, and James Brown was standing there, and he gave Isaac Hayes $3,000. He said, Isaac, I don't want to let you, don't let people see you be down like this. I want you on your feet so I can beat you again.
But that was part of his, the Southern thing is the Southern black man. That was part of his, don't ever anybody let you see you down. And that was a big piece of his personality.
Yes, indeed. And that's why he stayed, and, you know, after he would hit. Well, first of all, he taught a lot of this stuff to Al Sharpton. When you see Al Sharpton, you're seeing, when Al Sharpton talks, you're really hearing James Brown talk, because Al Sharpton spent 15 years traveling with James Brown. But James Brown's whole thing, his whole persona was that, you know, I want to be proper, I want to be dignified in front of people, I don't want people to see me poor, looking bad, I want people to see me proper. That's why at the end of his life, even when he was sick in the hospital, he never wanted people to know he was sick. He never wanted people. He would have been very disappointed with how this movie Get On Up shows him. You know, a man who spent 3 hours after every concert with his hair under the hairdryer so he would look clean, not just for his associates, but for the fans, because he really, he loved his fans. You know, my sister Jack used to say when she was my sister Jack worked in Harlem back in the day. And she said James Brown used to come out sometimes when people were lined up to see him and serve people coffee. And I've heard stories where he gave out bicycles, and he was always about education. I mean, I can't imagine.
That's what he told your sister when she went and knocked on his door.
Yeah, my sister knocked on his door, and he said, stay in school, Daddy. Don't be no fool. We talked about that for years. That was a big deal. Because his house was in Queens, not far from my house. We used to stand out there and wait for him to come out.
Never did, though.
No, I don't blame him.
there's so much here in the time we have. There's a one line here where about a white version, a black version, a historical version, a record company version. There's even an official version. People think about this, but
of his life.
Yeah, of just how people look at his life and what was missing.
Well, I mean, look, some of the fiction involved in James Brown's life, James Brown created himself. And he did that in part because he felt like it did, you know, he was talking to white folks. They didn't care what he did anyway, as long as he could sing and dance. But the other part was that being poor is complicated. Mm-hmm. You know, poverty is very loud. You know, it's full of things that are wrong, the wrong kind of sex, the wrong kind of mental health, if any. I mean, it's just full of stuff that just doesn't, it's just a ragged experience. So you just end up staggering forward from one moment to the next because you never know, you have no control. And so he tried to control his story. And it was an easy story to control because the Horatio Algier part of his story, where he was rags to riches, that's an easy one for journalists to tell. You know, he was born in a shack and, you know, and then he lived with his aunt who ran a whorehouse and then he became famous. I mean, that's all true with quotation marks around it. You know, it was Ann ran a whorehouse, was like a whorehouse all the time. It was a whorehouse for like 6 months. Were people living there that were maids also? Were people there living there who sold tin? And, you know, when I was sent down south, when I fell out of high school, I stayed in the south with my sister Jack, man. They did all kinds of stuff in all kinds of houses. I mean, you know, so what story are you going to tell? So, you know, I tried to get to like the root of it, like the deeper part of the man, because poverty is just really only one part of his story. There was a deeper poverty, you know, poverty of the heart.
You wrote that he carried the weight of, these aren't the exact words, but it was paraphrasing what you said. You wrote he carried the weight of black people, of oppression on his back. And you felt that weighed on him very deeply.
Yes, because he loved black America. I mean, I can't think of a star now, you know. I can't think of a star now that epitomizes that. You go and look on television, you see Lil Wayne doing a telephone commercial with him and his boys pouring a bottle of wine on a cell phone to show you the phone.
I saw that one last night for the first time, right?
I mean, come on.
The other night, yeah.
What are you telling kids, you know? What are you saying to them? I mean, you're just saying, just be a fool. Get a cell phone, pour wine on it, be a fool. These kids need to learn math and science, and they need to get ahead. You know, I'm tired of talking about the problems of black children. Let's just talk about solutions. James Brown was about solutions. I mean, he was so loved in black America that when he did stuff and when he said stay in school, you really believed he was like the uncle from down south who showed up at your house, would get drunk, take out his teeth, clomp him, quomp, quomp, and then put him in his mouth, and you'd be so embarrassed by him, but you know he loved you, and you loved him. That he had that kind of familial relationship with African Americans. And I don't really, I can't think of anyone else now who has that kind of relationship with this audience. That gave him real power, and I think he understood it. I think he misused it a little bit in his personal relationships, but professionally he never abused that. He never did sneaker commercials, never did wine or whiskey commercials. Even when he was broke, when he was bankrupt, and he lost his jet, he lost his radio stations, including the one that was here in Baltimore.
WBB.
He refused to do those kinds of things. He would rather be broke than do that stuff, and he was.
So that. Okay. Just your announcement for tonight. We'll make sure we get that out there before this is over. And I'm really glad you get in here in the studio. But so this is maybe too long to read. Maybe not, though. I just thought in some ways, there's a thing we wrote on page 70 that really, again, there's so much. I could pull out a dozen pieces like this that kind of speak to me as the essence of what it was like to be James Brown, and in the early years, you write this piece, when you write the early years when he became King of Soul. You can read this piece. Is there another piece you'd like to read in this book?
No, I mean, I'll read
it. What do you think of this piece?
All right.
I mean, you wrote it.
In the early years when Brown first became King of Soul, he had many annoyances that were ice cream and cake. His friendships and his relationships with women. Those were the fun years because Brown was young and strong with girlfriends and cars and his own plane and three radio stations. he and his best friend Leon traveled to New York, to Africa, to the West Coast. But in the later years, the weight of carrying that heavy load began to hammer down at Brown. He never slept. He called his best friend Leon at all hours. He worried a lot and tried to hide it. His friends began to turn on him, mostly around issues of money. By the late 80s, his great musicians were leaving or gone. His great musical directors, Pee Wee Ellis and Fred Wesley, had departed. Wayman Reed, the trumpeter, had joined Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers. Joe Dupar split for the Isley Brothers. Richard Cush Griffith, a gifted musician with perfect pitch, had left too, and that was just the trumpet players. The ever-loyal sax man Maceo led a revolt. The crucial rhythm players, drummers Jabbo Starks and Clyde Stubblefield, departed. Sweet Charles Sorrell, with his easygoing disposition and deep talent, who played keyboards and bass, who did everything, and whose solid grooves laid out the thundering bass of Say It Loud on Black and I'm Proud, who helped James keep his band together and pulled him out of bed when he was too tired or too high to go on. Sweet Charles grew tired of him and left. Brown always paid these guys, but who paid him? He always gave, but who was giving to him?
And that, to me, I mean, it's that, and there's so many other pieces of this book about getting again into the complexity of James Brown and not this kind of singular, linear person that we want to make him to be.
Well, I covered Michael Jackson during the 1984 Victory Tour. I was one of the few black people, black reporters that covered him. And Al Sharpton was on that tour, Don King. And Michael Jackson had that same kind of loneliness. You know, he was carrying all these people with him. And the media didn't really understand that. You know, they really made fun of him because, you know, they said he tried to be white and all this stuff. And his mother was such a nice person. He had such a nice family. The Jacksons are a very nice family. I never wrote about them or talked about them ever because, you know, I'm just not that kind of person. And the fact is they didn't talk to me for months because I was working for People magazine and they hated the magazine. They thought I was Uncle Tom and they just didn't speak to me for months. But I was there, and after a while, you know, they saw I just wasn't like that kind of person who would write, you know, stupid nonsense. But Michael Jackson and James Brown had that same, you know, touring with Michael Jackson for like 9 months helped me understand James Brown better because I saw the lonely space they live in. You know, everybody wants. No, everyone hates Goliath. You know, you go from being David to being Goliath.
Right.
Everybody hates you or they're jealous or they want something from you. I mean, I write about in this book, when James Brown died, Michael Jackson went to Augusta, Georgia. And the night before James Brown's funeral, you know, this car pulls up. The security guards get out. Michael Jackson comes out the car, and he spent the night with James Brown. He was there for like 5 hours in the funeral home with James Brown's body, combed his hair, fixed his face. He never sat down one time. And he asked about this gold coffin. He asked the guy, he said, "Why does he have gold?" And the guy said, "Entertainers like solid gold." And Michael laughed. And then 2 years later, you know, he was laying in his own gold coffin with the same kind of cacophony of crazy nonsense with lawyers trying to take his money and his mother fighting them off. You know, I feel very bad for Mrs. Jackson. I mean, I haven't seen her or talked to her in years, and I'm not the kind of guy that goes out and tries to hobnob with these stars. I really don't care. But whatever he wanted his mother to have, she should have. And whatever James Brown wanted these poor children to have, they should have. And the people, there's 48 lawsuits. 4,000 pages of testimony, 90 attorneys, most of whom never even met James Brown. And they just sue each other, and they just take his money and sue each other, and they bill his estate. And that's been going on in South Carolina for 10 years. And no one has said a thing about it. The only person who has followed it is a white, 62-year-old white grandmother from a small newspaper in South Carolina named Sue Summer. Mm. And they've tried to put her in jail a couple times. I mean, South Carolina is that's a different world, man. That's like 50 years behind the rest of America.
Well, I want to tell you that the folks listening to this conversation now, it'll be on our website at steinershow.org that you can podcast along with our conversation right next to it that we did with Good Lord Bird and Song Yet Sung. I really say, I'm not saying this to blow smoke, two of my favorite books of all time are those two books.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I just love those books.
Well, I should have gotten paid more, otherwise
I
hadn't gotten paid
you
more.
You get paid enough, you should go back and talk to him. So, James McBride, thank you for coming to the studio. It was really a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Senior producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast The Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Have a lovely weekend. Take care. Talk to you Monday.